20134, 201452. Emmanuel Beverly versus Matt McCauley. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Shimkus for appellant appellee.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I know you've told the clerk, but are you reserving time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 3 minutes, please.
All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon to Your Honors, and may it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Scott Shinkus appearing on behalf of the respondent. And as I mentioned, I will reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Your Honors, this is a rare child sexual abuse case in which there is, as the Michigan Court of Appeals put it, significant corroborating evidence. This includes statements from the young victim to his sister and his treating physician, physical evidence of abuse seen by both the victim's mother and the treating physician, and the fact that Beverly had twice committed other sexual crimes against minor boys. Accordingly, Beverly's trial counsel's admittedly deficient performance is essentially immaterial in this case because there was no reasonable probability of a different outcome.
Well, how do you deal with the fact that the prosecutor emphasized that this was sworn testimony before the jury? Doesn't that make it a material aspect of the case?
So, Your Honor, it's obviously not right. It's not good that the prosecutor or anyone else told the jury that this person was had sworn an oath or knew how to tell the truth or anything along those lines. But it's important to remember that the victim's statements also came in through other witnesses. And so the victim's testimony alone isn't the only evidence we're looking at here. The statements also came in through his sister, through excited utterances, and through his treating physician as a statement for purposes of medical diagnosis.
But the problem there is the victim gave contradictory statements about what had transpired. And there's discrepancies there. And he didn't get to state what had actually occurred at the trial, and he wasn't subject to cross-examination at the trial.
That is correct, Your Honor. His testimony differs from his preliminary examination testimony compared to, I believe it was the sister's testimony and perhaps the mother's to some extent as well at trial.
But and we also have the problem that because the testimony was contradictory, the state or the prosecutor switched theories in the middle of the trial as to what had factually occurred that constituted the abuse. And that's without there being any firsthand testimony as to what actually had occurred by anybody who had observed it. You know, they first it was said that he was, the child was digitally penetrated, and that was the theory of the prosecution's case. And because the child said something different from that, said that and some other things, then the theory was changed that the child was digitally abused, but also abused in a different way. So genitally in addition to digitally. So then the testimony was contradictory. And the theory of the case by the prosecution was changed in the middle of the trial without the victim or anybody who had witnessed the incident having testified. Isn't that a little bit of a problem?
So, Your Honor, all of that is true. Absolutely. But it's, for one thing, important to note that Michigan law does allow the amendment of the information through the trial. I cited that case in my brief, that if the evidence comes in slightly differently, they can amend the charges. But the other point here, Your Honor, is that it doesn't matter what the theory of penetration was, because penetration is penetration no matter how it's accomplished. So it didn't matter.
Well, there were other contradictory things. The child told the sister that the incident had occurred in the bedroom upstairs, and told somebody else that the mother or somebody that it had occurred in the basement. They're just all these contradictory things, and but let me ask you this: the judge at the trial did not examine the child to determine if he knew the difference between right and wrong or the importance of telling the truth. Even that small amount wasn't done. Isn't that a problem?
So if I may, Your Honor, that's true, that did not occur at the preliminary examination, but the judge did engage the child in somewhat of a colloquy, if you will, or a series of questions at the trial outside the presence of the jury to make the determination of whether the child was available.
Well, I can't remember whether the child was excluded based on that examination or whether the prosecutor decided not to call the child.
So, Your Honor, it was a determination of unavailability. And the judge,
unavailability on the part, the judge made the determination of unavailability.
That is correct.
Because of reliability?
Because the child was having trouble or I suppose refused to answer questions outside the presence of the jury from both the prosecutor and the judge. The child did answer a few preliminary questions, and I do want to bring that back to Judge Clay's question about whether the child was engaged and whether they knew how to tell the truth or not. And there were a few occasions where the child was asked sort of the example questions, do you know how to tell the truth? So the prosecutor said something like, would I be telling the truth if I said that I was a boy? And the child said no, because the prosecutor was a boy. And the judge, for instance, I believe was a male, and similarly the prosecutor asked, if I told you the judge was a woman, would that be true? And the child said no. So there were a few instances, and those appear on page 598 in our record.
But these questions were at the trial, not at the preliminary examination, correct?
Yes.
And so the preliminary examination, not testimony, but statements, were ultimately admitted at the trial.
Yes, Your Honor, through reading the testimony.
Can I ask something else, which is kind of changing gears
Absolutely.
Just a little bit? Did Mr. Beverly's prior convictions, how were they admitted? Did he testify?
No, he did not testify, Your Honor. They were admitted, I believe, essentially by stipulation. The prosecutor admitted the records, the certified records of his previous convictions.
Did that matter for purposes of what he could be convicted, the offense of conviction? Because ordinarily, you know, you wouldn't admit that kind of a prior record in the absence of the defendant's testimony, and if it's admitted just to show a probability that, I mean, I understand that's not the issue in this case, but I'm just curious about if they're admitted to show the probability that because he previously sexually abused a child, he did so in this instance, that would ordinarily be problematic. So I'm just curious as to how those prior convictions, on what basis they were admitted.
So, Your Honor, they were admitted under Michigan's statutory equivalent of this, the Federal Rules of Evidence, Rule 414, which it allows prior convictions of child sexual abuse to come in for propensity purposes. And those supersede any other acts, evidence, any rules per.
So this is a special evidentiary rule for child sexual abuse cases?
Correct.
Okay.
It is.
I understand that's not the issue in this case, but I was just curious as to exactly how that happened.
Sure, but it is relevant in this case because that's the
because it does go to the overall weight of the evidence.
Precisely, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That contributes to what the Michigan Court of Appeals called significant corroborating evidence. Even Judge Shapiro, in his concurrence, pointed out these prior convictions in addition to the child's other statements coming in through his sister and the treating physician, and the physical evidence. The physical evidence in this case was, frankly, for child sexual abuse cases, I would say rather rare. Because of the timing in this case,
The child's immediate reporting, you
correct,
mean?
Correct. He told his sister in the morning, I believe it was around 10 or 11 a.m., the sister immediately reported it to the mother. The mother called the police and took the victim to, or I believe the ambulance took the victim to the hospital.
And both, so there, and there was lay reporting of the apparent injuries to the child as well as medical testimony.
That is true, Your Honor. Yes, the victim's mother, I'll try not to get into any sort of graphic details, but the victim's mother did check the victim's buttocks and observed apparent injury, and so had the child taken to the hospital where it was confirmed that he had injuries there, both two tears and what the doctor called decreased tone, which, again, I hate to get too graphic, but the doctor specifically testified that this was evidence of repeated penetration from the outside in. And so
of
this
course,
is... yes, Your Honor.
Of course, there's no question that the child was injured, but this was a multi-generational household with friends and all kinds of people in and out of the house. So then the question is, who injured the child? And we've got a preliminary exam where there was unsworn testimony from a 7-year-old. In terms of the confrontation right, the function of the preliminary exam is just to bind somebody over for trial. All you need is probable cause that a crime is being committed and that the defendant committed the crime. That's not something that's ordinarily used as the only testimony for at trial to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. The testimony at preliminary examination is frequently limited and incomplete, and for strategic reasons, attorneys frequently don't go into a lot of detail at cross-examination. So doesn't that really accentuate the problem that there was a confrontation clause violation here, that this unsworn testimony of a 7-year-old with inadequate cross-examination is almost the entire basis for the conviction?
So, Your Honor, I will gently disagree with the last statement there, that was some sort of the entire basis of the conviction.
Well, the family member's testimony went to the fact that the child was injured, not as to who did it.
Again, if I may, Your Honor, the victim didn't tell his sister specifically who injured him, and that it was Mr. Beverly. And he also told his doctor specifically who injured him. And I believe the mother reported to the doctor as well that there was some suspicion that it was Mr. Beverly. But the victim's identification of his abuser absolutely came into the record.
By hearsay.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
By hearsay.
Correct. Admissible hearsay, Your Honor. Yes.
Well, that's a matter of dispute. I mean, the attorney didn't object to any, almost... the attorney for the defendant objected to almost nothing during all these proceedings.
Well, Your Honor, the attorney certainly raised some objections. I think the opposing counsel's point is, Your Honor, I see my time has expired.
You can answer. You can finish your answer at least.
Yes, counsel did raise several objections, admittedly. They're not necessarily the ones that habeas counsel now believes he should have raised, but he did raise several objections. The only thing I'll add, Your Honor, is before my rebuttal time, is that there was significant corroborating evidence in this case, so there can't be prejudice for the ineffective assistance claim, and any confrontation error was harmless.
Was the basis for the admission of the child's statements in close proximity to the abuse, I mean, it would have been some exception to the hearsay rule, either, you know, excited utterance or something like that, is that?
Yes, Your Honor. The statement was admitted specifically as an excited utterance to the sister, and then under the statement for purposes of medical diagnosis and treatment for the doctor as well.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Sophia Nelson of the State Appellate Defender's Office on behalf of Emmanuel Beverly. In order to admit testimonial hearsay at trial, there are two standards that must be met. Both Michigan evidentiary rules and the Confrontation Clause requirements of both Michigan Constitution and the federal Constitution. Neither were met here. If this evidence had been properly excluded, the prosecution would have been left trying an actual assault case without a complainant, and any prosecutor would tell you that is an exceedingly difficult thing to do. These issues get conflated somewhat, both, I think, in the Court of Appeals decision in the state court and also somewhat by the district court opinion below, these evidentiary requirements and the requirements of the Confrontation Clause. And I think this is understandable because, as recognized by the Michigan Supreme Court in People v. Cole, the Michigan rules are in part designed, by design, to protect constitutional floor. Now, they can go beyond that and include additional requirements, certainly, but here, Michigan Rule of Evidence 804, which allows for some exceptions for hearsay to be admitted, does in fact reference the cross-examination, which of course is also a requirement of the federal constitution.
Do you don't contest specifically the admission of the evidence that was presented, do you?
I certainly do. At TV's, the complainant, the child complainant.
Well, that was not presented. I'm talking about what was left, because the key question here, really, I mean, obviously, we know the attorney performed deficiently at the preliminary examination. The question is whether, given the unavailability of the child, the remaining evidence was such that there was any prejudice. And so I'm questioning whether you have any quibble with the admissibility of the evidence that was admitted at trial, or whether your argument is really limited to whether that evidence was so convincing that there was no prejudice.
So I have two parts to the answer. First, the complainant's statements at the preliminary exam, that testimonial hearsay, was admitted at trial. It was read.
Oh, I forgot about that. You're absolutely right. The complainant did not testify, but the statement was admitted.
A cop reenacted the complainant's testimony from the witness stand, and not just the prosecutor emphasized that it was given under oath or affirmation or qualified to tell the truth, but the judge specifically instructed the jury that that was the case. This jury was gravely misled, which undermines the reliability of this verdict significantly. But secondly, I do quibble with not the admissibility necessarily, but the content of the other hearsay. The only person who identified Mr. Beverly as the source of this injury, that whose testimony was admissible, was his sister. And that testimony was elicited from the sister. The sister approached her brother, who was crying, and asked her, did their nickname for my client touch you or anything? So we know, absent TV's testimony in this case, we would have had a very, very different trial where there could have been areas of cross-examination exploring the child suggestibility of a 7-year-old when they're prompted to identify a particular person.
I thought that your adversary argued that the child also identified his abuser to the doctor.
That is an area of great dispute.
Okay.
The transcript reads, the doctor said, I don't remember this examination. I'm testifying from my medical records. Obviously, the doctor never met Mr. Beverly, so wouldn't know who Mr. Beverly is. And the only statement the doctor made from the witness stand was, that man. And the record does not say, let the record reflect that the doctor identified Mr. Beverly as the assailant. Now, this was obviously
Was Mr. Beverly the only male individual residing in that household?
I don't believe so. I think Judge Clay's estimation of the household is a multi-generational household. I know at least 3 generations lived there.
Well, yeah, my information said it was the grandmother's house, and the child's mother and sisters lived there. But I've not seen anything that suggests to me that any other male lived there. Am I wrong about that?
There's nothing concrete in the record, Your Honor, that would say there was another male living there, but I think it's entirely reasonable and had TV.
So you would be speculating to think that other people came into that home and could have committed this abuse. There's no evidence to that effect, right?
Correct, Your Honor, but what this trial would have been if this testimonial hearsay had probably been excluded, either on Michigan evidentiary grounds or under confrontation grounds, it would have been a totally different trial, a trial without a complainant. And there would have been a totally different trial strategy, areas of cross-examination that could have been developed, expert witnesses that could potentially have been put forth about child suggestibility when you're prompting a child to give a certain answer, especially at that very young of age.
Well, let me ask you this. So there were physical marks or indications on the child that something had been inserted. Do you agree with that?
That this child was abused in some way, I think, is beyond.
Okay. So, and that's my question. So it's not that the child did anything to himself. It's that someone else did something to the child. Is that the defense in agreement on that point?
I would only be speculating as to what caused the injuries, but that something happened to this child, I think is obvious.
But there wasn't an argument at the trial that the child did it to himself.
No, but what the argument and defense could be at trial, absent the admissible hearsay, what we have here is an instance where it might as well have been have a letter that he had written down, and then he refused to show up to court, and we're admitting that letter as testimonial.
Right, but I guess what I'm getting at is for the prejudice point, I think you do have to establish, based on, it seems like the way you're presenting the case is that something happened, you agree something happened to the child, but that it didn't come from Beverly, it came from someone else. Is that the argument?
Yes, that would be the argument.
Okay.
That would certainly be the most obvious trial strategy that could be put forth absent TV's testimony and hearsay statements.
Okay.
And I just want to go back to the Confrontation Clause issue here. The Federal District Court, I think it's Record Document 1313, does find that this was a preserved Confrontation Clause claim, in that trial counsel did object on the grounds that there wasn't an adequate opportunity to cross-examine. And the quintessential—
Was there any mention of the word confrontation in the objection?
No, Your Honor. But the quintessential right preserved by the Confrontation Clause is the right to cross-examination. That's recognized by the Michigan courts and People v. Gaines, and of course by the United States Supreme Court repeatedly, that is, in fact, the purpose of the Confrontation Clause is the right to cross-examine in person, to explore inconsistencies, and to develop the record. And as Judge Clay referenced earlier, that the motives and the ability, first of all, this child was never cross-examined.
Wasn't the objection that there just was a different motivation at the preliminary examination than there would be at trial on the part of defense counsel?
That is a Confrontation Clause objection, because
how is that a Confrontation Clause objection? I mean, that goes more to just an evidentiary question, doesn't it?
I mean, I think that's the problem that I was trying to elicit earlier, which is that the Michigan rules of evidence are coextensive with the federal constitution. So we have here that in order to meet the evidentiary bar, there needs to be an adequate opportunity for prior cross-examination. But that is also a requirement of the federal constitution and the Confrontation Clause. And so whether or not this evidence was admissible under Michigan rules of evidence, obviously the Attorney General concedes that it was not by finding...
So this objection would... If you were arguing under state law, you would say it preserved the objection under state law, under the rule for cross-examination.
I think if you were preserving this objection under the Michigan rules of evidence and how trial counsel was found ineffective by the federal district court, you would object under Michigan rules of evidence 603, which require that prior.
Would you specifically invoke the rule?
You would.
Well, then why shouldn't you also have to specifically invoke the Confrontation Clause if you're going to raise a constitutional objection?
I think when you're pointing to a specific rule of evidence, you need to use the right number. When you're talking about a constitutional right, magic words are not necessarily what's required. It's speaking of what the right is. And in Michigan contemporaneous objection rule, MRE 103, requires that you identify the, when you're objecting to the admission of evidence, you identify what evidence you're trying to exclude and what the grounds for exclusion are. Here, the evidence is the transcript. The grounds are adequate opportunity to cross-examine. That's a right that's rooted in the confrontation clause. So this error was brought to the court's attention. The evidence that was to be excluded was brought to the court's attention. And the remedy, exclusion, is the same, whether it's an inadequate opportunity for cross-examine under the Michigan Rules of Evidence or under the federal...
Well, the point here was that he was not sworn, that the child wasn't sworn, correct? Isn't that the point why the confrontation clause was not complied with?
I think there are multiple reasons the confrontation clause wasn't complied with. One, there was no cross-examination because cross-examination...
Well, there was cross... There was no cross-examination at all at the preliminary examination?
Well, under Maryland versus Craig, cross-examination only happens when someone's duty to tell the truth has been awakened.
Okay, which is where you've had an oath, correct? So that isn't that what the complaint is when it comes to the confrontation clause that the child was not sworn?
Yes, it's also that the theory of as Judge Clay identified, the theory of guilt changed midway through trial, preventing cross-examination on the alternative theory of guilt. We have a unanimous jury.
Now, did you have any ruling from the court? At the trial, that on this, when this objection was raised, did the court talk about an oath? I mean, this was not even an issue, was it, before the trial court, as to whether or not the child had been sworn under oath, correct?
The court did not discuss the oath, but again, all the Michigan Rules of Evidence require for the contemporaneous objection is, one, that the evidence that's being excluded is identified and the grounds for exclusion is identified.
So the judge's comments aren't relevant to determining what the nature of the objection was?
I believe the judge's comments are certainly relevant, but I don't think they're dispositive. What we have here is a preserved constitutional objection on confrontation clause grounds that was treated as an unpreserved error by the Michigan Court of Appeals. And under Combs v. Bell, if a state courts erroneously deny relief on a preserved constitutional claim using procedural default and they erroneously apply it, this court can review de novo. And that would allow this court to apply Chapman properly, which has never been done, to this preserved constitutional claim, a violation of the quintessential right to confront the witnesses against you. The thing that upsets me so much about this case is lawyers and non-lawyers alike understand when you go to court, when you are accused of something, your accuser has to swear to tell the truth. This is not something that you need to have gone to law school to understand.
Well, I would say that your outrage is appropriate, but I think the thing that is problematic here, I mean, the lawyer messed up. His deficient performance is acknowledged. Who knows how in the world this child was permitted to give evidence, or not evidence, technically, but was admitted to tell his story at a preliminary examination without any of the normal procedures that would assist us. So the incompetence of counsel was great. On the other hand, this case is a bit unusual in terms of the degree of evidence that existed absent the child's testimony. So, I mean, so you're right, but you might be wrong in the end.
Certainly, prejudice under Strickland is a reasonable probability of a different outcome. Absent a complainant in a sexual assault case, there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome.
Can I ask you just one quick question? It's a little inaccurate to say that the theory changed. It changed to the extent there was a change in what the prosecution was contending. It was based on the doctor's testimony, and it was, I guess, another alternative theory, as opposed to a complete change of theory. Would that be a strict, I mean, I may seem to be quibbling over nothing, but I would probably characterize it a little differently.
Yes, Your Honor. I think what's important here is Mr. Beverly is entitled to a unanimous jury, a jury that all agrees on why he's guilty. And when you don't have an opportunity to cross-examine the complainant about the changed nature of the penetration, you may have four jurors who thought it was digital and four jurors that thought...
I'm not sure that unanimity would be required on that, but nevertheless, we're probably afield of what the issues precisely are here.
The reasons that I contend that Mr. Beverly is entitled to habeas relief, both on the preserved confrontation clause issue and on the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, is that this gravely affected the integrity of the system. You have a jury that was lied to about the veracity of the evidence, both by the prosecution and the judge. They likely convicted him based on TV's testimony alone, because they're instructed, you can believe this little kid. This little kid is telling the truth. He was qualified to tell the truth, and he told the truth. You also have an instance where inconsistencies were not able to be explored on cross-examination about, well, who was present? Because TV, at the Moran, said his sister was present in the room when this happened. And his sister testified at trial that if that's what he said, it was a lie, because I wasn't there. And about where, what room in the house this occurred. So there are numerous inconsistencies, the nature of the abuse, where it occurred, and who was present, none of which got to be adequately explored on cross-examination. But there is a reason prosecutors don't try cases without complaining witnesses. It's incredibly difficult to convince a jury that someone is guilty of something if the person it happened to isn't there. So I believe very strongly that there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome in this case, even with the sister's testimony. And of course, I disagree with the nature of the doctor identifying Mr. Beverly. I think that's impossible. You never met Mr. Beverly.
I know you're out of time, but let me ask you one last thing here. Just to clarify what it is that we as a court are reviewing, the district judge in granting the habeas found ineffective assistance of counsel. The appeal is on two bases: ineffective assistance of counsel and confrontation clause violation. The district judge found ineffective assistance of counsel. He didn't find expressly a confrontation clause violation, but he found ineffective assistance of counsel based on confrontation clause problems. So are we reviewing only the ineffective assistance issue, or are we reviewing both confrontation clause violations as well as ineffective assistance?
Well, I would put the court to 2 points in the district court's opinion, 13.13 and 13.16. In 13.13, the court acknowledges that this confrontation clause issue was preserved. And at 13.16, the court says that this violated clearly established federal law, specifically Maryland v. Craig, in the absence of the oath or affirmation. Now, in granting relief, the court says this was ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to object on Michigan evidentiary grounds, which is what the dissent in the Court of Appeals and the state court said. So certainly this court is free to affirm the district court on the basis of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. It's also, I filed a cross appeal, so the preserved constitutional confrontation claim is right for this court to rule on, or this court could remand to the district court for full consideration of the confrontation clause issue, although I think how the court would rule is readily apparent from its opinion, and that it found both it was preserved, there was an error, and it applied Strickland, and we know that Strickland subsumes Brack. So if they were applying Brack to the preserved constitutional claim, the same outcome would happen here with the prejudice analysis. So both are before this court. Mr. Beverly is entitled to relief on both claims, and there's lots of avenues for relief.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, Assistant Attorney General Scott Schenck is for responding. Just a few points for rebuttal. First, this goes back to the discussion that was just had, and to some extent, Judge Clay, your earlier questions about the discrepancies in the testimony. But I just want to point out, I know I did in my brief, but all of those discrepancies, anything the victim said, anything the sister said, the doctor, whoever, all of that information was in front of the jury. The jury was able to weigh whether they believed the sister's testimony, the victim's testimony, whatever it might be.
Although admittedly, the victim's testimony was incomplete, that was an unsworn statement at preliminary exam just for purpose of binding over for trial, which is to say, to establish probable cause. So it might be a bit of an overstatement to say that all of the evidence and testimony was before the jury.
Well, I suppose the point is, Your Honor, they heard these different versions, if you will, that opposing counsel is sort of touting on habeas review here. They were able to hear the victim say one thing from the preliminary examination and perhaps something different from his sister, but the fact is they heard that information and they could weigh that information. Your Honor, the other thing I would like to point out is the question that Judge Gibbons, you had asked about what the doctor had said in terms of the identification of the abuser, and specifically the doctor testified, according to TV, he used the victim's first name, but we'll say TV. According to TV, this man put his penis in his rectum. There didn't seem to be any dispute about who this man was. I know counsel said there was no, let the record reflect that the doctor identified the defendant, anything like that. But he did say this man. He did not say a man or any other man. He said this man.
That man.
This is the only man we're talking about, is Mr. Somewhat to that point, Your Honor, you had also asked if there were any other men who lived in the house. The record does show, I believe it was in the sister's testimony, that the victim's father lived in the house, but the sister did testify that the father was not home when this event occurred.
It wasn't established when it occurred. It's the problem. Nobody knows when it happened.
Well, Your Honor, the victim came to the sister, it would seem like it was pretty fresh, especially given the freshness of the injuries.
Seems fresh is different from somebody knowing to testify as to when the abuse transpired.
That is true, Your Honor, but there is certainly circumstantial evidence that abuse occurred in a relatively small window from the explosion based on the freshness of the medical evidence. And just briefly, Your Honors, the most important thing to remember here is that this court's review is under AEDPA. So it's not enough that Mr. Beverly shows deficient performance, he shows actual prejudice. He has to show that the Michigan Court of Appeals determinations on all of these issues, both competition and ineffective assistance of trial counsel, were objectively unreasonable. That no fair-minded jurist could disagree.
What if we determined the Brecht standard applied to confrontation clause? Would you still prevail?
Absolutely, Your Honor. For all the same reasons that there was no prejudice for the trial counsel claim, because there was so much other evidence here that even if we were to disregard the victim's testimony, the reading of the victim's preliminary examination testimony of the trial, all of this other evidence would have shown that Mr. Beverly, it does show that Mr. Beverly committed these crimes. And so for all these reasons, Your Honors, I'm more than happy to answer any
questions. Well, if the claim was forfeited as opposed to having been waived and was not adjudicated on the merits, it's arguable as to whether EPA applies under the circumstances of this case, wouldn't you say?
Your Honor, I would disagree with that. The Michigan Court of Appeals addressed both claims squarely on the merits. Michigan Court of Appeals addressed the confrontation claim, discussing whether the child was unavailable and there was an opportunity for cross, and the Michigan Court of Appeals explicitly addressed both Strickland prongs.
Well, if the Michigan Court of Appeals did not acknowledge the facts and circumstances of the testimony or were wrong about what had even happened procedurally, then there wouldn't be a reason to defer to the state court.
Well, Your Honor, even if the Michigan Court of Appeals got the waiver versus forfeiture issue perhaps incorrect under state law, that doesn't change this court's analysis of the constitutional issue about whether the confrontation clause was violated and whether trial counsel both performed efficiently and there was actual prejudice. then, of course, on top of all of that, whether those decisions were unreasonable. So for all these reasons, Your Honors, we would ask you to affirm the denial of habeas relief on confrontation claim and reverse the conditional grant of habeas relief on the trial counsel.
Thank you, and the court would like to thank both counsel for excellent arguments and presentation. There being no further cases for this afternoon.